Burke was famous for saying, before I give someone their freedom, I want to know how they're going to use it. And that to me is a very, very powerful quote that sticks in my mind and in some way identifies the difference between different approaches to government.
And I would suggest that there are many, many countries in the world, many nations, many cultures, where that is much more. Think of an Islamic theocracy, for example. Liberty has nothing to do with it. We don't want you to have liberty. You'll screw it up.
Right. It's complicated. Yeah. It has to be balanced.
Elaine?
I've now remembered my point, which was, if, as Jennifer suggested, that it is inevitable that people deplore these kinds of social inequalities and suffering. If it's really inevitable, why do you need government? And two, moral hazard, I think, is a very important concept, which we'll probably be calling upon more frequently. Just a reminder, this occurs whenever the rules of a practice give people a positive incentive to do the wrong thing. And agreeing with Bob that, yes, liberty doesn't tell you what the ends are. It simply makes it possible for those ends to be achieved. And I would suggest that under at least some understandings of virtue, it's a necessary precondition for the exercise of virtue.
Jennifer, one word.
Free rider. That's the
two words.
Sorry. It's one word. In economics, that's one word.
You said inevitable.
Right? Okay. At this point, let's turn questions over to the audience.
Chris, are you running the queue?
Hi, I'm Marta. Is microphone on? Mm-hmm. Cool. I'm Marta Johnson from Hamilton College. I think Robert Cranach brought up the role of ideology in the growth of government and then consequently the decline of limited government. But the ideologies that he brought up were the progressive ideology, the welfare state ideology. But I think a lot of people would be comfortable calling libertarianism and conservatism ideologies themselves. So is it the role of ideology per se in that, does ideology per se grow government, or is it just certain ideologies? Put another way, if, as Jovenel seems to be saying, especially in sovereignty, the Minotaur twists every ideology into its service, does this include the ideology of limited government?
Great question, yeah. I think I can answer that in the following way. An ideology is an abstract theory which you use to reconstruct reality. It has some notion of constructing or reconstructing reality. So it has some kind of an underlying assumption that there is not a permanent and fixed human nature, that there's not a kind of given order or created order of things, that we can reconstruct the world in some way. I mean, Roger Kimball referred last night to Obama's notion of transforming America or having a transformative view of his role. I think that's a reflection of an ideological approach to politics, that they're always thinking of, in some way or another, reconstructing human nature, reconstructing the world. We could call it social engineering or whatever. I think that distinguishes ideologies in the precise sense from other philosophies or ideas of government. Limited government is actually ultimately based on the notion that human nature places certain limits on what politics can do. So that's the absence of an ideological approach. That's the opposite of an ideological approach, because it's sort of saying there's something given or fixed or permanent about the order of politics, which we can't ultimately and fundamentally change by social engineering or by combination of technology and state power. So an ideologist really thinks the world is malleable. You know, they can make it in any image they want. And that's why they get drunk on power, in a way, and think that that people are foolish if they don't see that potential for transforming the world. So I think that's a useful distinction, right? So not everyone is an ideologist.
Okay. I got a bunch of people want in on this. Charlie, Adam, Kevin, Flagg, and Tiffany. Charlie.
I was just going to make the brief comment that I think your point is an excellent one. I think that part of the argument here, and maybe what you're referring to as well, is that the Minotaur is capable of conscripting ideology toward its end. I think it's a real possibility, and maybe one that's been overlooked, that its end is to grow itself. So you know, people who seek power promise to shrink government and to have a smaller government. It never happens. Over time, government grows, and it's just what goes on. So in the service of itself, it's possible to state that it will shrink itself. The result is likely to be the opposite.
Adam.
I do think of limited government ideas as having an ideological character to them. And maybe one way of getting into the problem that I've been thinking about just in this session is about the free rider problem of the welfare state. From one ideological point of view, you have people who are getting public altruism for nothing, and they're the free riders. From another ideological point of view, you have all these people in the private markets who failed to freely give to those people who need help, and they're the free riders, and so you solve the market failure by having the government provide the public altruism. And both of those seem like ideological positions. So on the one side, you have people who are getting something for nothing. On the other side, you have people who are not giving their fair share.
Kevin.
Yeah, Marta, I think that's a great question. And the short answer is yes. yes, limited government can be ideological. I agree with Adam. Yes, conservatism can become ideological. In other words, I think as it was broadly characterized, I think ideologies are what Juvenal calls taxonomic devices. They're time-saving devices, right, to give you a kind of broad stance on what you should think about an issue. And so, of course, right, a kind of ideological stance on limited government could save you thinking about whether in this case it's actually applicable or something like that. So, yes, I think it is true, as was pointed out, too, that it may be the nature of the Minotaur to subsume ideologies into itself, not just rhetorically, but actually, so all sorts of philosophers who are for freedom suddenly find themselves serving power or something like that. So I think that can happen. I would also say that I agree with the assessment that if there's something kind of recalcitrant or, you know, irremediably resistant in human nature, then an ideology, when wanting to reform that, would be problematic and would be something like alchemical, right? I won't use the word Gnostic. Sometimes it was that you're trying to change the nature of the thing or graft a new nature onto the thing, especially if it's malleable. But I think part of Juvenal's point is that if power has a nature that is resistant to our conceptions and our efforts to restrain it, then it's completely ideological to just decry its advances or to think that we can change the way that government operates, right? In other words, here's another thing that has a nature, not just human beings. And if it's resistant to just any old way of thinking about it, and maybe all ways of thinking about it, then it's fanciful and deluded to just talk as if these people are just naughty or something.
Flag.
Just very quickly, the other aspect I would add to Bob's account of ideology, and this comes from some of the anti-communist dissidents, the thing that they identified as being common was this idea that the ideologist has a key that supposedly unlocks the logic of history, right? So there's this very rigorous account of how history has proceeded up to this point and how human action can move history either in a new direction or, you know, continue it in the direction that it's already going. So I would just add the malleability of human nature combined with this claim about to understand the logic of history. That's what distinguishes the content of, I think, true ideologies from, you know, things that just end in ism, right?
Tiffany, and then Jim, and then let's ask another question. Tiffany.
I want to complicate things a little bit insofar as responding to Bob's definition of ideology, and particularly as in reference to the ideology that underlies the expansion of what's commonly called the welfare state in the 20th century. And that is, if the essence of ideology is that it represents a departure from nature, a departure from the idea that man has a definite nature that imposes certain limits on what can be achieved, the architects of the welfare state, the progressive architects of the welfare state, did not understand themselves to be departing from human nature. They understood themselves to be the agents of our perfection. In other words, they were historical thinkers, and in their understanding of history, history has an end, which end represents the perfection of our nature. And so they were very keen to turn the government into the engine of achieving that perfection. So this wasn't, in their understanding at least, and I would distinguish that from the understanding of contemporary liberalism, but in the earlier understanding, they understood themselves to have a teleological understanding of human nature, and that government now, in the writings of Richard T. Ely and others, in redefining government in terms of that perfection, they were restoring the comprehensiveness of the political association explicitly like Aristotle.
Jim.
You talked several times about market failure, and I hope I did not misunderstand Adam Kischel. I think it's a good time to clarify that. The purpose of a market is to promote mutually beneficial exchanges. If I want to sell my home, I'm willing to take $200,000, and there's someone else out there who's willing to pay $300,000, but for a variety of reasons, we can't get together easily, or at least at a reasonable cost. I can't find the person. The other person cannot determine at reasonable cost whether or not I hold clear title of the property and so on. That is a market failure. If, on the other hand, I want to sell my home for $10 million and there's no one out there who's willing to pay anything near that, that's not a market failure. So if the market does not bring about my contributing to some impoverished person, I don't see that as a market failure. The market didn't do what someone else wanted it to bring me about to do, but that's not a failure. That's a little bit like the young child who goes to his parents and says, wants something, and the parents say no, and then the young child tells his friends, my parents didn't listen to me. Yeah, they listened. They just said no.
Both Charlie, did you have a quick comment?
Yeah, just one quick point, kind of building on Jim's. It might be a little bit of a false dilemma to think that there are two different paths to the same end. So you can use the coercive mechanism of government to have people do something, or you can rely on the market to do it. In the former case, you have tremendous, you know, for example, transaction costs and unintended consequences. So it's not very efficient. In some ways, it's true that you can have efficiency or poverty, and maybe not both. So it's not always approaching one problem two different ways.
And Adam, and then Lou.
I just wanted to agree with Jim. You know, I think on the social welfare side of the market failure argument, it would be something like, if only I could find the homeless people to help them, I would have helped them, but the government knows where they are, so let's have the government do it instead. Right? If only I could find the people who are hungry, I would provide food and money for them, but the government can do that better than I can. And so there, I think from that side of the argument, there really is a sense of market failure, although I don't particularly agree.
Okay, great. Lou.
Hi, my name is Brenna Hafer. I'm from the Matthew J. Ryan Center at Villanova University. And as a student of Dr. Colleen Sheehan, I think it is entirely appropriate that I quote James Madison. So Madison says in the Federalist Papers, "Justice is the end of government. It is the end of society. It ever has been and ever will be pursued until it be obtained or liberty be lost in the pursuit." Now, you touched upon this a little bit, but I would like you to expand upon the connection between virtue and justice and also liberty. What is the relationship between those things? Thank you.
Yes, we will go there immediately, but we'll also, we're going to be talking about exactly these things. Mm-hmm. I mean, the concept of natural law as it relates to this, the concept of social justice, the concept of equality, how all of these things are bundled up together. This is, in some ways, the crux of the issue. What is the definition of justice? Mm-hmm. You know, where do you get that? Where does it come from? Where does the law come from? Where is the framework from? Pamela, go ahead.
Well, I agree with everything you said, so that lets me off the hook. But I really liked the question and just wanted to respond in one way. We've been talking about the need to define liberty and therefore to define liberty expressly, so that we don't confuse the terms. And what you read from Madison, in a sense, reminds us, I think, that I'm borrowing this line from Harvey Mansfield's essay for the next session, but that from the standpoint of the American founders, and I think from Locke as well, political liberty is the crux of liberty. And political liberty means self-government. And the sort of anti-authoritarian streak, so that when Locke says we are born free, what he means by that is that we are under no obligation to submit ourselves to anybody's arbitrary will, that there are no natural rulers whatsoever. And it's our political status that he seems to emphasize when he's talking about what human nature is. And I think that that's carried over really in the American founding. And if you read, for example, our little selection from John Adams, which I'm sorry is also for the next session, but John Adams seems to suggest when you tell people that they are self-governing, you don't just get survivalists, you know, anarchists. You don't just get don't tread on me people, people who resist anything coming from government. What you get are people who learn to see themselves as self-governing beings, not hypothetical selves, but as people who are responsible ultimately for the way in which the laws come out. And under those circumstances, certain virtues will in fact emerge, because it's a rather noble way of looking at what a human being is. Fear doesn't do it, honor doesn't do it, but self-government, particularly the practice of self-government, does elevate all of us, and I think that that's important. So at least one start on your question, I think, would be to consider the importance of political liberty in the definition of freedom of, say, Locke and the American founders.
Bob. Yeah, it's a great question, and it's kind of a transition to our next session, but to answer briefly, I had a student go through the Federalist Papers, kind of circle the word justice and the way in which Madison used it. He tended to use it to mean the protection of minority rights. In other words, majority rule combined with protection for majority rights. And so he was plugging into the older notion that justice is the common good, right, which goes back to classical thought. But he tended to define the common good primarily in terms of majority rule and the protection of minority rights, which is more in conformity with the classical liberal notion of what the common good should be understood as opposed to a more Greek or Roman or medieval view of it. So, yes, justice is a big word. It's a powerful word. They were all in favor of justice, and they gave it, I think, a fairly precise definition in terms of a kind of classical liberalism and a kind of liberal constitutionalism.
I was wondering what the panel thinks about this issue. In conversations with some of my more liberal friends, I am told that the movement toward the left and socialism is, quote, inevitable, and that all of us conservatives are merely holding actions against it, but we are fighting against a rising tide. What do you think?
Go right ahead.
That's kind of an interesting question, because I think there are a lot of Americans who certainly hold that view today, and I would take that back even further. The idea that the state needs to get involved in the very long list of things that it does that began to become particularly clear in the Progressive Era and during the New Deal, and certainly exploded even further with the Great Society. And in reading some of the progressive authors, again, I mentioned Richard T. Ely a moment ago. In his autobiography, he talks about this, and he basically suggests at one point in the book that he presents these kind of policies as inevitable responses to changing economic circumstances, first and foremost, economic circumstances. And I think a lot of Americans think of those policies in that light today. So they're inevitable. But later on in the book, he suggests and that it's rhetorically useful to make people think these are inevitable, because that gives them less cause of resisting. And in fact, in his own understanding of economics, economics as one of the social sciences is situated between the physical sciences, which is dealing with firm and unalterable laws, physical laws. The social sciences is dealing in part with necessities that can't be ignored. People have to eat, for example. But indeed, in terms of how we organize our economic relations, there is a room for voluntary choice. And in fact, over the course of history, that's what they thought was expanding. So in Ely's day, they actually, and on the one side, this is inevitable, on the other side, they were congratulating themselves because they were consciously choosing to elevate the character of our economic life. So in their own understanding, this wasn't necessarily inevitable. This had to be brought consciously into being. Whether it's inevitable today, given kind of the accretion of this thing, given how deeply rooted the understanding is in the minds of elite as well as the American people, that I think is a separate question, and I'm not very optimistic about it.
Jennifer.
So I think that your liberal friends probably mean that in this sense, that it is what the right-thinking, reasonable person would have the world look like, and that eventually we will all come around, and so it's inevitable. I don't think that's true, but I think that they actually might be right. As an economist, when I hear the word inevitable, I immediately begin to look for the systematic forces that are going to draw us in that direction, whether we think it or not. So, you know, if a hurricane disrupts the oil platforms in the Gulf, it's inevitable that the price of oil is going to rise, at least briefly, right, as our supply chains are disrupted. And so, but there are systematic forces there, right? This is not some mysterious inevitability. It's a thing that we can pinpoint. So if you were to look for the systematic forces that are generating the inevitability of a march toward modern liberalism, I think that you might actually find some. As we get richer, our tolerance for watching other people suffer in any way is actually declining, right? And so I think that that combined with the fact that our individual voices in the vote have so little impact actually leads us to do something called expressive voting, which is, we understand that we're not really actually going to be able to affect the election. So when I vote to make a statement about what it is that I want to see in the world. And I want to see, you know, puppies and flowers and children being happy, right? So even though voting for some sort of these liberal policies might have consequences that are against my own interests or even against, you know, the interests of the people that I'm trying to help, being able to say that I'm for children and for, you know, trees is more valuable to me than actually attempting to help children, right? And so I do think that there may be some inevitability to it if we don't recognize this as a real issue, right? This problem of our votes or our expressive natures in the role that plays in the political process.
Just quickly, Mike and Charlie.
Great point, Jennifer. So in addition to us getting richer, there's another force that's going to lead us there as well. If you read Ricardo, he's very worried about the problem of rents. And right now, if you look at our national product, 2/3 of our national product is paid out to labor, 1/3 to capital. And it's been pretty consistent over a long time. But if you can imagine technical change getting so good that we all press a button and get our food and housing and all that, there's a question of how those current laborers actually get anything in that new world. So there would be an impetus to redistribute, nationalize. And I think about this. I'm very worried about it. There's also another thing working in the other direction, perhaps, that, well, maybe it's just too costly to collectivize everything, and so prices will rise, and maybe that's what you can rest easy thinking about. But I'm voting with Ricardo.
And Charlie.
I think this goes a little bit back to the ideology point we were discussing earlier, but I think I'm not sure about the liberal aspect itself. I think the inevitability probably lies in the state's likelihood to grow, whether that's through programs oriented around, you know, publicly stated to be oriented around having a welfare state or having more wars or whatever. I think that the standard is that Minotaur is going to be likely to grow. I think Margaret Thatcher said something about eventually we're going to run out of other people's money, so that's probably the point when it'll stop growing.
Really short.
All that is necessary for evil to triumph is that good men should do nothing.
Okay.
Hi, I'm Max Schnidman, Hamilton College. One of the issues that seems to have been brought up throughout this entire panel has been the Minotaur and the nature of the Minotaur. Is the Minotaur intentionally something that is a problem that, say, does it intentionally grow itself? Or is it more akin to a force of nature that can be used for good or for evil? Or perhaps is there something within the Minotaur itself that leads what would be considered what were once good people to engage in policies that increase power, increase the role of government, and therefore prove detrimental to society? Thank you.
I just quickly jump in on that one. I believe that there's a kinship between Hayek and de Juvenal here in that both of them see these as impersonal forces, right? I mean, for Hayek, it's the market. There is nobody to blame. I mean, it's the accumulated decisions of zillions of people. In the same way, de Juvenal doesn't see the Minotaur as being something that is being led by some nefarious creature out there, but it is the collective decision of these impersonal forces that gets us to this place, right? And that's de Juvenal's point. In some ways, de Juvenal is a very non-judgmental person. He's simply saying, look, this is the way it is. It's not that there's some bad guy, and I don't even know whether this is necessarily a good thing or a bad thing. I'm just saying that this is what is. If you look at history, this is what's been happening. It's a really interesting observation. We're officially out of time here for this panel. Jim. So we'll go with Jim.
Briefly, Max, I think it's the latter. Once you have a tool, you have a strong interest in using it. It's like giving a 5-year-old boy a hammer. There's no telling what he's going to hit with it. Pardon me? That's right.
It's a great place to end for this panel. We'll be back in a half hour, so thanks very much.
Thanks.